Hello and welcome to the Commotion Mobility Podcast, your regular glimpse into the future of urban mobility. As always, I'm your host, Greg Lindsay, Director of Strategy for Commotion. And once again, I'm joined by Jonah Bliss, VP of Media and Marketing here at Commotion. Thanks for coming back, Jonah.
Hey, Greg. Always a beautiful day inside our apartments.
It's gorgeous outside, but, you know, I'll never know here in my basement. But, you know, while we shelter in place, the world of mobility continues onward, and particularly with delivery. I was going to say, what I love is what's happening is the incredible profusion of new dining options that are out there every day, including my new favorite, Pascal's Pizza. Who knew it was actually secretly Chuck E. Cheese creating a ghost restaurant inside of its shuttered locales? Who knew that Chuck was back there making the pizzas? What's your favorite ghost restaurant that's not really a restaurant?
Well, for starters, you know, I can sort of understand Chuck E. Cheese's position here. No one's gone for the pizza. So if you saw that pop up in Grubhub, you might have second thoughts unless they bring the ball pit with them. But I also saw that Applebee's is also doing a little secret name swap. If you want neighborhood wings, that might still be coming from Applebee's. There's, you know, who knows? I'm sure there's other ones we haven't even uncovered yet. You know, what is Chili's doing? What is Outback Steakhouse doing? We need investigative reporters on this stat.
Well, and then there's the question of what they're even doing inside of it. So, you know, my favorite other two stories this week when it comes to delivery is one, people noticing that, you know, that Domino's Pizza is the original cloud kitchen when you think about it. You know, really marginal real estate, not really about a dining experience, dispatch delivery drivers, social distancing, timing and convenience. They built an app for delivery. And what do you know, in a much discussed infographic, you know, Domino's Pizza stock has outperformed, you know, the big tech five over the last decade or so. So perhaps we should be paying less attention to, I don't know, Google's Alphabet's autonomous car strategy, and perhaps more attention to Domino's.
The big tech breakthrough was those bags that trap the heat, so your pizza actually shows up not tasting gross. And get this, employees and paying them.
Well, and then the other lesson from pizza is the new get rich quick scheme that some enterprising folks have discovered on DoorDash. Would you like to recap that about how we can basically make guaranteed 75% profit margins on every pizza sold?
Yeah, this is a great story. And anyone that reads the margins on Substack, you're going to be a step ahead of this here. But basically, someone set up a pizzeria in all honest intentions. I think this was somewhere in the Midwest. Noticed a surge in delivery orders, as I'm sure every business is currently given the pandemic. And I forget exactly how they pieced it together, but basically Grubhub had scraped one price for the pizzas. I think like the price of a basic pie, just a straight cheese pie, but was applying that price to all sorts of fancy, you know, supreme pizzas with all the toppings. So let's say you could order a supreme pizza for $12 on Grubhub. The pickup person would come to the restaurant, throw down $20 for the supreme pie, and then the restaurant basically pockets all that difference. And eventually the owners caught onto this and figured out, you know, why do I have to wait for the customers to put these orders in? If I just place orders myself, I'm basically printing money all day long.
The truest incarnation of basically how to profit off Silicon Valley. I mean, you know, entire companies have built multi-billion dollar valuations doing the same arbitrage to SoftBank over and over again. So
I think eventually they stripped it down to basically just delivering themselves straight dough, right?
And they speculated that if you really want to, you know, complete it, you just bring the driver in. And so the driver hangs out at the bar and records himself as having delivered the pizzas, and you've now completed the loop.
Some SoftBank chart is showing nothing but, you know, look at our customer counts are growing, 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 and we'll figure out the profitability later.
If you prioritize top line growth is exactly what you will get. Well, that brings us to the SoftBank earnings call. For those of you who are fortunate enough to see it, Miyoshi-san pointed out that, yes, sooner or later, all those unicorns fall into a ditch and only the Pegasus will survive. So I really hope that out in the valley right now, you know, when they're talking about Clubhouse, the hot new app with $100 million valuation, that they're going to call it a Pegasus. But I get ahead of myself here. Before we get back into the news, I want to point out, as I should have at the very top of our podcast, that in a little bit, we're going to have Henrik Holland, who's the CEO of Greenlots, which is one of the more interesting electric charging startups that are out there that was acquired by Shell last year, I believe, along with several other interesting portfolio companies that sort of point to the future direction of Shell when it comes to building a complete integrated stack for electric charging for renewables. So Henrik's going to talk about what Greenlots' master plan is ultimately, and also sort of how they fit into what this emerging ecosystem of generation and charging will be. Because, and I say, Jonah, I thought it was interesting, I haven't looked into the details, but it appears Tesla has finally made good on their plan to allow bidirectional charging in and out of the cars. And I know years ago, Morgan Stanley's incredibly bullish analyst speculated that Tesla would morph into this rolling power grid of batteries, and perhaps that day is finally here, or at least the capability of it.
Yeah, that's really exciting. Yeah, you kind of helped with grid peak load and off-peak charging. Can sort of do some demand smoothing so we don't have to have as many plants running all the time. And, you know, for me personally, as someone that back in the day when we had an office, I could charge up the office, steal all that free juice and bring it back to my house and talk about arbitrage.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, one of the news stories that popped out at me, of course, was the, James Dyson, the British billionaire, famous for his vacuums and other electronics, taking a little bit off the wraps of his £500 million dead electric car project, which he spent all the money on, pulled the plug on his own fortune on it. But it was interesting. You know, he promised that it would be effectively what looks like an electric SUV that was going to have an unprecedented 600-mile range, only a top speed of about 125 miles per hour. But couldn't make the battery work. And I bring this up because, you know, last week on Commotion Live, we had Roger Atkins from EV Vehicle Outlook. And he pointed it out that, like, you know, just never understood how the battery chemistry would work for something like that. So I don't know, that continues to be sort of the constraint for that. And Roger pointed out that the only company that really has truly cracked the battery is Tesla. So we'll see if this adds to their, you know, growing lead, if they can actually finally create that integrated energy stack of, you know, solar panels on the roof from Solar City, which is now sort of a shadow of its former self, your Powerwall in the garage, and your, you know, fully self-driving electric Tesla alongside it. But
is it just me, or did that Dyson car look suspiciously like a Range Rover? You know, I was expecting a little bit more of a, you know, plexiglass, bright colors, you know, Dyson ball looking vacuum car, and it's just a sleek, boxy, silver SUV. I think I already know a British brand that makes those.
That's true. You're right. I wish we had at least, like, yeah, you're right, some yellow plastic and, like, yeah, dissatisfying all around. I think we can agree on that one.
Give us that kind of Nouveau Pomo 90s gloss.
Indeed. Well, what other stuff that's popping out is, you know, I mean, broadly speaking, beyond the realm of mobility, one thing that's happened just here today as we record this is that, you know, Facebook's made this announcement that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg saying that, you know, that, you know, in addition to being allowed to work from home out through into 2021, they're going to start aggressively moving towards remote workforces and paying to match. And it's really part of this whole interesting argument, which continues to play out about, you know, yeah, you know, are we going to see more people move to the suburbs? You know, we're seeing cities fight to keep people out of their cars by opening up their streets. LA has been the latest in this, but also this potential movement of people, like, now leaving cities, watching large scale employers realize how much they could arbitrage their real estate commitments and also their employee salaries, as Facebook seems to have done, by pushing people out of cities. And I don't know, it's really interesting to sort of see how that gathers a pace, because that's, you know, the one big winner of that, I imagine, will be the automotive makers, you know, putting fresh wind into the sails of the 10-year auto boom that had just ended before this crisis.
It's interesting that this turns out to be arbitrage week, right? Facebook said that you could, starting next year, you can work from wherever, but your pay is going to be matched to the local pay scale, local cost of living. So there's definitely someone that's got to come up with a little algorithm to figure out, you know, where is the rent cost, you know, slightly differs from the overall cost of living, so you can maximize the take-home pay relative to your expenses. And I'm sure some, you know, very clever Facebook engineers are already working on that problem.
No, absolutely. And then in cities, as I mentioned, you know, just moments ago here, is, like, you know, then we've got, you know, we had London and Transport for London, Christina Calderado, on the last Commotion Live talking about their efforts to open up streets. We've seen cities around the world. We had the deputy mayor of Milan on Commotion Live a couple of weeks ago talking about their efforts. And I bring this up because there's been we're reaching the point where really tough questions are being asked about these efforts, which are being, you know, incredibly fast-tracked, often without, you know, a ton of community review. And, you know, Alyssa Walker had a great piece in Curb this week asking about, you know, are urbanists playing out their fantasies on the streetscape on this? And I'd seen previous pushback in Oakland, for example, where, you know, some of the 74 miles of open streets there were through communities of color. And, you know, local activists were rightly pointing out, like, who are these street closures for? Who was consulted on this process and who's actually empowering it? And it'll be really interesting to see if we've now entered a backlash phase in this, a rightful one, in the sense of, you know, is this white urbanist fantasies being played out when it comes to mobility? And this, of course, has always been the tension, Jonah, in, like, cycling, right? About, you know, given Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and all sorts of, you know, racial stereotyping about who rides bicycles. So it'll be very interesting to see whether this is a, you know, yeah, how micromobility is carried out going forward and for whom.
Yeah, or to borrow the numtot lexicon, for whomst. But yeah, exactly. Open streets, yeah, what does that mean? And who is allowed to access those streets? Who's comfortable in their own neighborhoods? What does changing physical infrastructure mean to the people that actually inhabit these cities? It's one thing that on a rendering and a, you know, top-down view, oh, like, you know, the streets are safer for pedestrians. That's great. But if it's only, you know, a certain affluent set of pedestrians, that's not a win at all.
Indeed. Well, speaking in that vein, I was saying, I'm curious if other investments have jumped out. You know, we've seen, you know, that there seems to be an ongoing shift in the conventional wisdom that, you know, that perhaps the micromobility fleets may die or maybe constrained, but in their place will be a new profusion of vehicles that people might own. And, you know, we've talked a bit about some of the electric bike makers that have been raising funds out there. I'm, you know, what else jumps to mind in terms of other interesting sort of fundraising that's happening amidst this? Because as we've established on Commotion Live, you know, VC money continues to pour into these companies. So what jumps out? What's this week in venture, Jonah? We should start that as a regular feature.
Well, to kind of hit both your points there, X-Wing just raised $10 million. They're kind of AV for eVTOLs, but I think their big difference is that instead of trying to do a whole hardware stack, they're really a software solution that integrates with existing hardware. So, you know, I can see why investors be interested in something that's a little less capital intensive right about now. And then for me, the other big the big news is our friend Dimitri of Tortoise, the self-driving teleoperated scooters. I think they finally just launched outside of Atlanta. And to me, that's pretty exciting because it seemed like pretty pie in the sky tech for a while. But now if you're in this select office park in Georgia, you can have a scooter scoot itself right on over to you and get on it.
Well, that's interesting. You know, I've been very bullish. I'm still proud of the fact that I helped bring Tortoise into to Commotion LA last year because I've been on the hunt for the mythical self-driving scooters that have been in various skunk works around. And I still think it has the most value as a fleet redeployment tool to balance this stuff out. But I am glad that he's chosen like office parks, right? Like this is the kind of thing we need to crack, these huge suburban footprints where, you know, can you actually walk out of an office if we ever go back to an office and have your scooter there or walk out into your cul-de-sac and use it? Because otherwise the land use is just so self-defeating that, you know, most Americans in particular are not going to walk down the street to grab a scooter. It's, you know, and so it'll be interesting to see, like, you know, just how much we can bring it to them. Interesting. What else has caught your eye this week, Jonah?
Well, I think, you know, we've just talked a little bit about suburbia, right? That's, you know, way out in the Atlanta burbs. And so the census just released its, you know, annual update to the fastest growing cities. Although city might be kind of a kind term for a lot of the places on the list. But yeah, as usual, it's dominated by the South and the West, but sort of a general mix of suburban and exurban places. A couple days ago, you know, Jordan Freight on Twitter was doing a fun little game of, you know, what city has the best suburbs or the worst suburbs? And I think maybe we want to play that with this current list. So I don't know, do you have it up in front of you, Greg?
I don't. I do know that I weighed in on this exercise for Jordan, and I actually picked the classic suburbs of Chicago and Atlanta, because I would argue that, yeah, that the worst suburbs are some of the most segregated. In that particular case, it was, you know, looking at Milwaukee and some of the politics there. But others rightfully pointed out, you know, some of the most sprawling ones, obviously, too.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, doing this quick list of census hits here, we got Leander, Texas, Apex, North Carolina, great name, Chico, California, Doral, Florida, Bentonville, Arkansas, Meridian, Idaho. I mean, it keeps going, keeps going, keeps going. So yeah, can we ship you off to Frisco, Greg?
I don't know about that one, but, you know, but it is interesting to look at, you know, you've got, you know, a number of fast growing towns as well. Here's Carmel, Indiana, classic upscale suburb of Indianapolis, you know, huge ones. Frisco, Texas. I mean, Frisco is the archetype of the Metroplex fast growing suburb. And that one is interesting because of some of my other research for new cities. I mean, Frisco is an example of exactly what Tortoise would like to do. It is a suburb 30 miles north of traditional downtown Dallas, but it's one that's basically trying to densify. Developers there are turning old office parks into new walkable mixed use districts with, you know, that has hotels and housing and everything else. And it'll be curious to see, again, we are in this moment, although I'm getting a little bit optimistic here about, you know, when you hear all the news about potential vaccines in the making, that this will be a blip and not something that, you know, will torture us for years. It'll be really interesting to see how these suburbs develop. Perhaps there will be new dense cores that people will drive to and then ride their autonomous scooters around. We'll see.
Yeah. No, it's, I mean, there's definitely always a continued evolution in the suburbs. I'm curious. I don't think Frisco is on Dallas's fast-growing, sprawling rail network. Looking at the list, it might be that Irvine, and I guess Milpitas too in California, only ones that have even the most vestigial of rail connections, right? So something you can maybe scoot to and then get to where you're going without getting in a car.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, this is going to be the whole task going forward, right? How do we retrofit these places? And hopefully we're not breathing new life into them. So we will see. Of course, I guess I'm out of myself there as an urbanist determinist, but so be it. Well, with that, we're going to turn over our guest here. We've got Henrik Holland, as I mentioned earlier, from Green Lots, and he's going to talk a bit about, this notion of like, how do we, going to back to our previous themes of Commotion Live and elsewhere, about continuing to drive forward electrification. And as you can imagine, a now Shell-owned company, they are not as worried about oil prices as we are, at least not that part of the company. We might think of Green Lots as an excellent hedge about some of the larger geopolitical petroleum intrigue that's going on. So with that, let's turn it over to Henrik. Thank you for joining us, Henrik.
Thank you, Greg. Really a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
No, well, it's great to have you here. Well, I guess as a way of framing Green Lots for our listeners, Shell in late April announced, that the oil supermajor was going to be, net zero by 2050, which always raises a few eyebrows when they do that. But, Shell has quietly been acquiring companies like Green Lots for the last several years. I know Sonnen quite well as one sort of building a virtual power wall as well. And I was hoping you could start a bit by talking about what sort of Shell's ultimate ambition is here by acquiring you and these others in terms of like what kind of portfolio and sort of full stack charging strategy there. What's the ultimate aim of it?
Sure. Happy to talk a little bit about what we've done, what Shell has done.
Where do you fit in the scheme of things? Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. So Shell started a new energies business in 2016 after already having spent really kind of decades working on different aspects of renewables. We were number one, two, or three in solar and wind in late 90s, early 2000s, got wound down a little bit. I think what's really different about our effort today as compared to two decades ago is that obviously, from a cost competitiveness perspective, renewables is in a completely different state. So if you look at what, our company is doing today, we are investing on the kind of upstream side of things where we generate energy. We are investing in expanding our trading activities, which in North America is represented by a company called Shell Energy North America, which is actually, it's a bit of a secret, is one of the biggest wholesalers of power already in North America. So we sell a lot of electricity already to the retailers that you as a consumer will buy your power from in deregulated energy markets. And then there's the, let's call it the kind of downstream services side of things, where we will and are already selling power to commercial industrial customers and consumers. And I think the way that a company like Green Lots as well as Sonnen fits into that picture is by really moving towards a more services oriented model where you as a consumer will not just be buying a kilowatt hour, but you might be buying a flat rate type product, which includes a home energy management system or a energy efficiency system for your business, including on-site storage to manage your demand charges, as well as with some solar on your roof. So I'd say that's kind of the three components of where we're going. As Shell as a business. And I think that electric mobility really straddles, the downstream consumer bit and kind of goes into trading. So as you think about the vehicles that we're managing, the charging that we're managing, and the Greenlot software is really built to do this, we're managing the flexibility of those resources. And that's a value to our traders in that middle component. but it's also a value of consumers, because we can help our customers, you know, drive down the cost of charging their vehicles and using their cars. A segment where we're doing a lot of work right now, where I'm really excited about some of the opportunity that we have even near term, is in the fleet space. So as we think about providing the lowest possible cost of energy to these fleets, there's a real opportunity to get there by smartly managing the charging of those vehicles. So that's really an area where Shell can bring together components that are pretty hard to bring together if you're not a big integrated player like us. That's the power provisioning side, the trading, as well as the software to manage it all and kind of bring it together.
Yeah, I was asking what sort of the interesting use cases you're looking at or where you think going forward? Because, you know, regular listeners of this podcast will know that, you know, a few weeks ago we had on a couple of EV car analysts effectively debating about what ultra low oil prices and the recession would mean for electric car sales. But there's, you know, there's a whole universe of EVs beyond that. And I know, you know, in the before times, you guys had just announced a deal with Volvo to sort of look at their trucking fleet, not their cars. So, yeah, I mean, what's your sort of strategy or use cases looking at, you know, freight, logistics, all these other areas of electrification that go beyond simply buying a sedan?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And when we think about, you know, electric mobility, and I love this space because of it, you know, we think of these really sexy new electric cars, the electric Hummer. You know, of course, Tesla makes great vehicles. People are buying them because they are, you know, attractive things to buy. And you talk about that in your podcast. There is a whole world indeed beyond the consumer vehicle. And I do believe that a lot of the kind of near-term real economic cases for electric vehicle adoption kind of lie in that space, right? So where consumers might buy a car because it just looks really neat and you want to be a technology adopter. On the fleet side, the promise of electric vehicles, you know, first of all, emissions reduction, of course, which also has an economic and regulatory definitely angle to it that can really drive adoption. It's the total cost of ownership of these vehicles. So there is a real promise that if you look at, you know, the longevity, the maintenance, fuel cost, you know, that becomes perhaps lesser of a driver in a low oil price environment. But if you look at all those factors, I think that there's a real economic case to be made in the near to medium term for, let's say, the class of vehicles that delivers, you know, your Amazon packages to your house, to electrify those. And that's where we're starting to see real customer interest with large, you know, delivery companies to really look at, you know, perhaps initially a few pilot projects, but we really see these companies thinking long term and thinking larger scale.
Interesting. So I'm curious how that sort of evolves over time, and going back to a bit about what we talked about services, because I've been thinking about that as well. And I'm curious, like, if you could spin that forward a couple of steps about what that ultimately looks like, right? I mean, it's, you know, an ultimate vision for you then in one, along at least one dimension, is going to customers and, yeah, providing complete turnkey, you know, energy charging management, and, you know, providing a single bill kind of thing like that, right?
Absolutely. I mean,
So what does that look like as that matures then? I mean, you're sort of like, you're basically the industrial partner who's supplying this to all these trucking companies or and then again to consumers as well. How do you imagine Greenlots evolving then along those lines?
Yeah, well, I think if you kind of squint your eyes a bit and look into the future, think about like a mobility PPA. And if that ever becomes something, then it's known that I said it here in this podcast. Mobility PPA, like you buy the full suite of services to maintain, you know, the energy balance or maybe even the vehicle through a PPA type structure, which takes into account, you know, the cost of energy as well as the cost of the infrastructure that's needed to manage, you know, the running and charging of those vehicles. Where I would see Greenlots play into that with Shell is really to deliver, you know, the analysis, first of all, up front to help fleet owners decide on how to run these vehicles, maybe even route optimization, figuring out what type of infrastructure is then needed for those vehicles, taking into account, you know, the full energy envelope of a building. So also looking at your charging location, am I going to bring in a bigger utility pipe, or am I going to also utilize on-site generation? How am I going to manage the energy balance there? And then I think other bits of Shell come in to understand what the value could be of the flexibility that's created on site, making sure that we deliver the type of power that the customer is looking for, you know, the type of green footprint that that the customer might want. So I think that's how we bring it together. I think Greenlots there has a very important role to play in really the technology and delivering these projects to our customers.
That's really interesting. See, I wanted to bring that up because we always talk on here, of course, a lot about mobility as a service. But, you know, I've yet to see someone make the leap then, like we just sort of did here, to like electromobility as a service, where you unify that piece of the stack as well. Because, yeah, as you mentioned earlier, like total cost of ownership has always been the great argument for EVs. But it's that, you know, that reptile brain, you know, in customers about where they just simply can't grasp that. I mean, if you could combine it into a complete service package,
yeah,
I could imagine like that maybe has the curb appeal, so to speak, to actually make that an easier sale kind of thing.
Yeah, I think so. I think to these fleet operators, I mean, you're really talking to folks that talk dollars and cents. I mean, yeah, frankly, I think even environmental concerns generally, unless they are regulated to do so, I don't think that's a primary driver for adoption in many cases. It's the economics and, you know, what governments tell them that they need to do. I think we're starting to see those things come together where some of these use cases now are starting to make sense. I think what really does need where I think we're still seeing a bottleneck is in the availability at the right cost and scale of the vehicles themselves. I think the technology is kind of there on the infrastructure side, but we need to see more vehicles come to market. That's I wouldn't say that's what we're waiting for, because we're not waiting, but definitely, you know, further innovation, cost down on the vehicle side will be needed. And, you know, thinking about COVID and the impact, I'm hopeful that things would not be delayed from that perspective, but I am a little cautious about it at the same time.
Yeah, I was going to say we only have a few minutes left, and it doesn't behoove us to ignore the Great Depression in the room, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, you know, I mean, Greenlots is also part of this ambitious proposal that came out in late April, this transportation electrification partnership that,
yeah,
involving City of LA and a consortium of OEMs and Greenlots, you know, if proposed, would earmark like $85 billion for electrification, yeah, infrastructure.
Right.
What's your thoughts on what's your path forward as a company going through, you know, what is effectively the Great Depression too? And, you know, obviously there's also a presidential election and possibility yet for some sort of stimulus for, you know, energy changeover. You know, any immediate prognostications, and how has that affected sort of Greenlots' growth plans going forward?
Well, I think, first of all, I think, you know, there's a lot. I think many of your readers, you know, listeners will be aware of, you know, supply chain disruptions, slowdowns economically that generally can just happen because of COVID. But I think what we are seeing as well is that we have cleaner air now. And
yeah,
there was a Harvard study recently that looked at 3,000 counties across the United States that found in those areas where there was higher pollution, they were more likely to suffer fatalities from COVID and other respiratory illnesses. We're seeing surveys that people, you know, they like where we are now from an environmental perspective, that the skies are just cleaner. So I think that there is some, hopefully some societal tailwind coming out of some of that as well. As a company, we are making ourselves robust to what we could be seeing as fallout from this. But fortunately, you know, we work for a parent. Our investor is a parent who has a very long-term outlook. The energy system demands that, right? It takes long time to develop the types of projects that Shell is used to running. And I'm confident that Shell as a company has a very robust and kind of long-term outlook and belief in the development of a strong, you know, cleaner mobility sector, which will include electric mobility, but also hydrogen, for example. So we continue to charge forward and really have a long-term view on where this space is going to go.
Great. One last quick question. You know, we recently had an episode of Commotion Live where we talked about rethinking the street. And I thought it was really interesting that the Italian federal government has created like a 500 euro subsidy for lightweight personal electric vehicles. I'm curious. I mean, you know, it's straddling, you know, multiple nations and, I mean, a global oil super major. You know, what are you looking at in the global landscape? Just as a spectator, you think of some interesting programs or interesting initiatives to spur on further electrification? I mean, obviously China gets a lot of play for their policies and incentives. And I'm curious, you know, if there's ideas the United States should adopt or others from overseas, what do you think those should be? What would be your recommendations?
Well, I think it's very, very clear that in Europe, and I'm originally Dutch, I'm a dual citizen. I would love to see a lot more ambitious goals from cities about curbing the use of ICE vehicles in cities. I think we're seeing some really aggressive targets now in Europe in specific cities that are really going to continue to drive progress. Right. So I think, you know, low oil prices will people, maybe they will delay the purchasing of an electric vehicle, but it's just very clear in some parts of the world that society is choosing a different pathway forward. They're choosing a different future. And that is being translated into these very ambitious targets where, you know, cities are saying, you know, we're going to change and we're going to do it regardless. And I think the U.S., the strength of the U.S. is that once something catches on, it's like Americans can do anything quicker than anybody. And I think we can win and really, you know, drive adoption very, very quickly. We have the technology, but I think we need to make a conscious decision as a society to do that and let our lawmakers know that that's where we want to go.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us, Henry.
Thank you so much for having me, Greg. Real pleasure.
Well, that was fascinating. Yeah, I'm still continuing to be bullish the notion that, you know, that we're all going to have, solar energy too cheap to meter someday through a combination of, you know, home storage, electric vehicles, localized charging infrastructure, renewables. But we'll see. But in the meantime, Jonah, I don't know. It's close to dinner time here on the East Coast. I think I'm going to go order a pie from Pascal's Pizza. It seems like a nice new local option that's popped up here.
Ooh, yeah. I hear it's very cheesy. Don't get your hands too greasy, so when you head over to the Cruisin' USA arcade cabinet, you can still grip the wheel.
As long as I get plenty of tickets for placing my order. Maybe it's the new loyalty system that'll go into some of these ghost restaurants. We will see.
Is there an app for that?
Well, with that, thank you. Thank you again for joining us, Jonah. Thank you all for listening, listeners. And we will be back soon with another episode of the Commotion Mobility Podcast. Take care.